Have you heard of Malcolm Gladwell? Yes, thanks for the hand raise. I loved it. Malcolm Gladwell is a writer. He's a journalist who's written a couple best-selling books. Malcolm Gladwell is one of these just fascinating writers, though. He's able to take a situation, a scenario, and turn it on its head and give you a fresh interpretation. He has this ability to inspire you with this new take on what it means to be human. He says it this way in one of his articles he wrote, "There's more going on beneath the surface than we think, and more going on in little finite moments of time than we could guess." The genius of Malcolm Gladwell coming to Wildflower right now. And what's fascinating about this is some examples for you. He writes articles about things like pasta sauce. And he shows you what's going on in American culture through ragu. It's amazing who does that. He was asked to write an article on a dressmaker in LA who makes $500,000 dresses, and he found that utterly uninteresting, so he wrote an article on the guy on the street corner who makes $8 t-shirts. This is a fascinating writer in our culture. And in fact, he's the type of writer who's really inspired and sort of kept his pulse on what's going on in our culture. He is invigorating, he's fun, and one other thing you cannot leave here without, he has an amazing curly fro, amazing. If you know nothing about Malcolm Gladwell, look at the curly fro, rocks the curly fro with finesse and great style. Malcolm Gladwell grew up in England and then later in Canada. Malcolm Gladwell's mom is actually from Jamaica, and she's a psychotherapist, and his dad is from England, and he's a mathematician. I have no idea how that works out in their family system, but it helps us a lot because Malcolm is fascinated by interesting people, and he's fascinated by numbers. So he does a lot with sociology, he does a lot with psychology, and at times he combines them in just a fascinating writing form. Malcolm Gladwell is one of those people that our culture, that our generation loves to listen to. He writes for the magazine called The New Yorker. And if you don't know The New Yorker, this is like the hip culture magazine of the moment. You know that it's cool because when you flip through The New Yorker, the first four pages are all kinds of art exhibits and poetry shows and rock concerts happening in New York. And that's just really, really cool. But that's not all. The New Yorker has fascinating comics. My son loves the comics in The New Yorker. And then it always stays up with criticism on our culture and what's going on. And so he's spent the last 15 years with The New Yorker. Early on, he was just a no-name journalist for 10 years, just sort of working on his craft. And so he writes about pasta sauce, and he writes about these $8 t-shirts on the corner, and he writes about identity. He writes about how we succeed and how we fail. He writes about how our minds make decisions. And when you read him, there's a sense of, wow, this guy, this writer has his just finger on the pulse of our culture. And just recently, in a few articles in a book that he wrote, he talked about his loss of faith. And he talked about that just through all this activity, all this writing, he just had this deep sense of loss, of kind of disconnection from the Christian church. And it fascinates me because this loss of faith is something that many of us know very well. This is a culture now where we're not the South. How's that way of saying it? We're not the South anymore. And there's this deep sense of loss, and you hear it underneath us as a culture. We celebrate Easter, and it's amazing, but there's a sense of we all have these doubts, and we all have these skepticisms and these criticisms. And one way of saying this is this, this is what I'll say, that the doubt is not the absence of faith. There's no silly, this is doubt, this is faith, and faith is not the absence of doubt. But the loss of faith is about a growing skepticism towards institutional Christianity, a distrust of dogmas and doctrines and power structures, and this ambivalence about Christianity's relevance to our lives. And this is where we're at as a culture. And it's often hard. It's hard to explain this to my grandma, right? Because she grew up where not only did they go to church on Sunday, but they went to church in the middle of the week as well. And we live in this culture because of busyness, because of many things, that has this sense of loss. And I want to tell you this morning that I don't think this loss is a bad thing. Sometimes you have to be lost to be found. Sometimes loss needs to happen so that certain things can die, so that there can be a rediscovery, so that there can be a new sense of fruit and harvest in Christianity in America. So there's this loss, and the way I describe, for me, where I feel the loss of faith most is I've grown so doubtful of forms of Christianity that are about shame, that are about fear, that are about sort of these tactics of you must come, you must feel guilty when you don't do certain things. And this shame and guilt, it's just, our culture just has an over-tolerance from it, and we just back away and we don't like it. And it does some really bad things because we're supposed to be the people of love. We're supposed to be the people that keep inviting and inviting, these people that let grace be everywhere around us. And so we live in this culture where we still have a form of Christianity that's about guilt, that's about shame. It's like this, few months back, Trey and I got to take my son to a Denver Bronco game. And as we're walking out the door to the Bronco game, we see the man who's standing on his pedestal preaching at you, right? And he literally was yelling at my son. And my son, I love their innocent eyes of our kids. And he's like, "Why is that guy yelling, Dad? And what's he yelling about?" And the guy is just spewing this stuff out of his mouth. And my son is like super confused because he's like, he basically is like, "We believe in God, right?" And I'm like, "Yes." But this confusion over what Christianity is, and I have this sense of loss in our culture of this form of Christianity, it's about shame and guilt when we were created to be the people of love over and over again. And then I have this sort of, this thinking about, as a culture, I have this loss of faith, of this doubt around power. And where power structures sort of block out people and don't serve them best, where power is manipulative, where pastors tell you you should believe everything they say, that's crazy talk, right? I mean, you do not believe everything I say. There's a big problem if you do. And what this is a form of power, a form of us forcing people to be in our boxes. And Christianity was never meant to be like that. It's meant to be this open field of freedom where there's this incredible sacredness to our questions, where everyone has sacred worth and there's a freedom to ask and to doubt and to be yourself in community. So we have this culture that we live in with this loss of faith. And Malcolm Gladwell is an incredible sort of picture of that. This incredibly insightful man who confesses his own loss of faith. Well, just last year, Malcolm wrote a book that he calls, interestingly enough, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Don't you just want to buy it based on the title? So good. And Malcolm Gladwell, right? The man who talks about pasta sauce, ragu, and makes it interesting. And so Malcolm Gladwell in this book, he had this incredible encounter with the Dirksen family. Wilma and Cliff, they live in the plains in Canada, very simple people. And 20 years ago, William and Cliff went through the absolute terror of their daughter being brutally murdered. Her 13-year-old daughter is brutally murdered, and the police come to the Dirksen's home, and this is what Cliff says. "We would like to know who the person or persons are so we could share, hopefully, a love that seems to be missing in these people's lives." Say, "What, Dad? This is crazy talk," right? To share the love that seems to be missing from these people's lives. Now, the mom is much more raw and honest in her grief at this point, but she says this, "I can't say," and she stresses it in her voice, "at this point, I forgive this person, but we have all done something dreadful in our lives or have felt the urge to." This couple, this incredible couple in this no-name town in Canada, they're obviously deeply committed to their Christian faith, and they come at this whole thing with this deep commitment that we're going to be people of forgiveness. And no matter if this grief process is long and hard, we are not going to be people who continue the hate and the pain that we have felt. We're going to end this cycle right here and right now. So Malcolm Gladwell is sitting at the table with Wilma and Cliff, and this is how he describes his experience. "When I sat in Wilma Dirksen's garden, it is one thing to read in a history book about people empowered by their faith, but it is quite another to meet an otherwise very ordinary person. In the backyard of a very ordinary house, who has managed to do something utterly extraordinary. Malcolm Gladwell saw, in the midst of his doubts, in the midst of this loss of faith, a power that was emanating from this couple, something deep, something rich, this power to forgive no matter what, this power to walk through the grief and to stop this spiral of anger and hatred. And he's converted. And he writes this article about how this is the moment in his life where he rediscovers faith. And I think some of the forms of faith of Christianity need to just die so that other forms, these pure forms, these just unbelievably raw forms of forgiveness, of love for others can flourish again. We can kind of cut away everything that's built up over the years and get to the heart of what it means to call yourself Christian. Malcolm Gladwell rediscovers faith. That's why he writes the book David and Goliath as this sort of challenge for all of us to figure out this power source and where it comes from. I find it really fascinating that there's a scholar of Christian origins named Luke Timothy Johnson, and he spent his entire life studying the New Testament and studying the early Christian movement. And as you, if you probably don't know because you're not all Bible nerds, and that's okay. But there's a lot that's said about why this little fledgling movement of 10 or so people become this movement where all of us gather and eat good food and sing great songs with one another. And so a lot of scholars say, oh, it's because of the creeds, or it's because of the movement, it's because of the charisma of Jesus. And Luke Timothy Johnson says this, we've missed it. He says, it is because this man died on a cross, and there was this empowering love. There was a resurrection, not only in him, but there is a resurrection power that is in breaking into the lives of Christians everywhere. That rediscovering our faith means rediscovering the power that God gives to each one of us. This surging power of hope and faith and love that burns within each one of us. And so this scholar says that this language of the New Testament is the language of power. It's a language of rediscovering that God is a God who gives us the power to live distinctively Christian lives. And so if you notice the way early Christians, remember, they live in like random house churches across the world. They are the underdogs. They use language like this in the New Testament. We are being saved, transformed, reconciled. We were in darkness, now we're in light. We were in slavery, now freedom. We were in the flesh, now in the spirit. Remember that earliest Christianity has no Roman authorities. There's no one in high-ranking powers, and they were empowered by this resurrected Christ, this experience that stirred them to do things like preach and prophesy and speak in tongues and heal. They were empowered to care for the orphan, for widows, for sick people, for prisoners. Remember, this is a culture where there is haves and have-nots. It's not an American democracy where we have this this hope that we all could be the next president, right? This is a culture that told you to stay in your place. And these early Christians are saying, we are finding a power within us to love, to forgive. We are finding a power that a power that gives us faith in the midst of a world that treats us like dirt. We are finding in the midst of our hopelessness a hope that goes beyond. We are finding that in a world where we are very different, love, a love that is triumphant, a love that is all comprehensive and all inclusive for people. So Luke Timothy Johnson argues that it's this resurrection experience, and it's what Malcolm Gladwell found at the table with Wilma and Cliff, this surging power that comes from God, because the resurrection just didn't happen. It happens again and again and again in our lives with one another. So this got me really excited because I wanted to preach a good sermon on Easter Sunday to you, and I started thinking about the passage that was read for you today, this incredible woman, Mary Magdalene. And it's a fascinating passage because it goes like this. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. First thing you need to notice here, where are the men? Gone, right? All the men are gone. And actually, for the first 400 years of Christianity, those who don't believe in Christianity, the critics, they're like, where are your men? Because the women were at the tomb. It was actually a criticism on them. Because in ancient literature, when Socrates dies, he's surrounded by his men, right? His friends. But in this literature, it's absolutely unique in world literature where It's a woman at the tomb by herself. And we can think of, what is she doing there? You know, maybe she's mourning this loss of faith in this person. She had thought Jesus was going to be something, and now he was brutally murdered. And maybe she's mourning, or maybe there's something in her heart that says there's something more to this story. There's something I can't figure out. There is a power that is going to be available for all people if I just hold on and figure this out. But it doesn't matter. She shows up by herself alone, and she sees the tomb has been removed. She has no idea what's going on, so she does this. She ran and went to Simon Peter, another disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to him, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Then, boys will always be boys, by the way. Here we got the foot race going on. Then Peter and the other disciple set out and went toward the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. Obviously, the beloved disciple wrote this and got to say he outran Peter, right? He bent down to look in and saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb. He saw the linen wrappings lying there and the cloth that had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. From the beginning of this passage, we have this heroine, this incredible woman who is looking into the tomb. And then all this metaphor is about looking. It's about seeing. It's about rediscovering. This passage is centrally about what it means to lose your faith and what it means to find the strength to rediscover faith once again. So then the passage goes on. It says, then the other disciple who reached the tomb first also went and he saw and believed. Okay, we think this is hopeful, but then, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. And here's the clincher. The boys think they've solved it. They have no idea what's going on. Then the disciples return to their homes. And Mary's there alone at the tomb by herself. What a great story. This woman is tenacious. She wants to figure this out. Her heart is restless until she figures out what's going on. And so she's there at the tomb by herself. And Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she bent over to look again into the tomb. She went to rediscover what the heart, what the core of this faith is all about. And then it gets really exciting. She saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there. But she did not know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and she said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God." So this ancient woman who doesn't have a lot of what we call in this world, she is the very first to see the resurrected power of Christ. And so she's sitting there in the tomb. And she is the one that has to go tell the disciples, "Look, there is a power that's surging out of this man, this rabbi, this Lord that we've been following." And Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples with great courage, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. Can you imagine the men? They're like, "Okay, Mary Magdalene, we got it." They missed out. They missed out on this. And this woman becomes this great heroine. And the faith would have never been moved forward if it weren't for this empowering power of Mary Magdalene, rediscovering what this faith is all about. That this faith is about, there are many, many places of death. Place of death of all our understanding of God, place of death in our life. But this is the God of new life. This is the God who brings to you again and again the power of resurrection. Our lives are built around this cosmic metaphor of death and new life. Losing our faith and rediscovering it again and again and again. In 1942, in this small French town named La Chambon, Jorge Lamarand, a commander in the Nazi army, came. He showed up. Germany had defeated France. There is terrible, brutal murders happening all around the country at this moment of Jewish people. And so Jorge Lamarand comes to this small French town. Germans have defeated France. Hitler is marching forward with his Nazi Germany. And he decides he wants to make this a Nazi youth Hitler camp in La Chambon. But what he didn't know, in La Chambon, it was a Protestant Christian community that was powerful and that was alive. Their pastor, André Trocmé, said these words in a sermon just a year before he came. Loving, forgiving, and doing good to our adversaries is our duty, he said. Yet we must do this without giving up and without being cowardly. We shall resist whenever our adversaries demand of us obedience contrary to the orders of the gospel. We shall do so without fear, but also without pride and without hate. This is to Hitler. This man lives in France, and Hitler is a strong world power that's on the rise. And this pastor has the courage, the resurrection power within him to say to his community, this is where we're heading. We're headed with great strength and great power. And I say to this, I have no idea what this clergy collar thing is. But if I could speak words of boldness like that, I'll wear one of those any day. And look at those sweet glasses. Holy cow. And so this man, Jorge Lamarand, he has no idea what is going to happen in this small village, La Chambon. And at this time, the students all gathered together. It was incredible energy, and the whole energy is, man, Germany could come and squelch us at any time. And at this time, many Jewish refugees are coming to La Chambon. And the school, it's hilarious, the populations in all the schools grow from like 100 to like thousands. And of course, the German army is saying, what's going on here? Oh, nothing, sir. Nothing, sir. All these Jewish people who are escaping death, right? Who are being hosted by these Christian families. It's so beautiful. And then the students got together in order to protest this Nazi commander. And they, with André Trocmé's help, they said this: we have learned of the frightening scenes which took place 3 weeks ago in Paris, meaning Jews going to extinction camps, where the French police, on orders of the occupying power, arrested in their homes all the Jewish families in Paris to hold them in the Ville de Vivre. The fathers were torn from their families and sent to Germany. The children torn from their mothers, who underwent the same fate as their husbands. We are afraid that the measures of deportation of the Jews will soon be applied in the southern zone. We feel obliged to tell you that there are among us a certain number of Jews, but we make no distinction between Jews and non-Jews. It is contrary to the gospel teaching. If our comrades, whose only fault it is to be born in another religion, receive the order to let themselves be deported or even examined, they would disobey the order received, and we would try to hide them as best we could. We have Jews. You're not getting them. That's amazing. You're saying this to Hitler. This is an incredible story of a group of Christians who said, we're going to take resurrection power seriously. We're going to take this power that emanates from the cross. We're going to rediscover what it means to be people of faith and people of hope and people of love. And this same resurrection power that was swelling is present in our community here. There's a young woman, a young family who comes who told me this the other day. I have found my tribe. I want this community to be my community. I want my husband to be around these men. I want my son to know these kids. I want to invest myself into these women. This is my tribe. And the pastor weeps and hides away and writes this down really quickly in his journal. There is a resurrection power, a surging that's happening within us that's absolutely beautiful. We have three different families that are present here who have decided, because of the love that they feel in their heart, they're going to adopt. And so we have Bob and Gretchen, who adopted Marky Jing from China. And 2 weeks ago, while Tim and the band were singing, Marky Jing was getting his groove on right here. Resurrection power within us. And then we have Angela and Josh, who are giving their lives to two boys. Some people adopt one, other people adopt two, right? And then we have Todd Allen, who's adopted these amazing kids from Romania, resurrection power. And we know that this is, they're going to need us to surround them, but we are seeing this resurrection power in our midst. So the question becomes, if we're sitting at that table with Malcolm Gladwell, if we're aware that there is this rediscovery going on of what's critical, what's vital, the question is, how do we let our lives be shaped by this resurrection power? How do we be people that say we are going to stand up for faith, hope, and love, no matter what the costs are? I think there's three central things. We need to be people about planting. We need to rediscover community. We need to rediscover the strength and power it is to be with one another. The strength and power we find from encouragement, that we find from music and from teaching and from saying we are going to be this people. This is what it means to be Christian. We rediscover community. And we rediscover community, that means freedom. That means question asking. That means continually striving for our very best selves. And we do some watering. We rediscover again Eucharist. This good gift, this bread and this cup that tells us the story over and over. This is the God who poured himself open and broke himself apart for us. And we do the same for the world. It's this incredible metaphor of death and new life over and over again. And this is how the world becomes new and transformed. And then we do the pruning. We commit ourselves to rediscovering discipleship. Rediscovering what it means to be people who follow this ancient way, to be people of forgiveness, people of compassion, people who love our enemies. So as we Easter people move forward in our service, I want to say this blessing over you. May you rediscover faith this Easter and live with resurrection power. And may the eyes of your heart be wide open to Jesus' presence. And may you become the person that others see the extraordinary in. Amen.